Now, this is not Prescott Bush Sr. This is Prescott Bush Jr., the brother of George Herbert Walker Bush and George W.'s uncle. And his name emerged in connection with the scandal surrounding Covenant House and AmeriCare. It's not that Prescott Jr. was ever linked to child molestation, but one of his cronies was charged with that. And the way that the wheels of power seemed to turn on behalf of Father Ritter and Covenant House suggests that the offices of George and Prescott Bush Jr. may very well have been recruited on behalf of the unfortunate Mr. Ritter and Covenant House. There was also an investigation by a very conservative Republican Congress or a Nebraska state legislator at this time, a guy named John W. DeCamp. John W. DeCamp had been looking into the collapse of the Franklin Credit Union in Omaha, Nebraska, and came on allegations of organized child molestation deep within the upper echelons of the Republican Party, and a number of people who had been present at parties where children of both sexes were allegedly molested by powerful Republican politicians. One of the people whose names cropped up was that of George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, whether there's any truth to the allegations about the skull and bones activities that were voiced to me by this informant, whether that has anything to do with some of the allegations of child molestation and sexual irregularity, I cannot tell. But I wonder about some of that. I wonder whether some of the machinations of skull and bones ultimately results in the blackmailing of some of these future power brokers, because the skull and bones does channel people into the ranks of the American power elite. Ultimately, despite the fact that the 1988 election of George Bush should have been negated by the Iran-Contra scandal, George Bush was elected. His campaign was managed, overseen in considerable measure by George W. One of the small scandals that emerged, should have been a big scandal, but it was a small scandal that emerged during the course of the 1988 campaign, was again the presence of these Nazis and fascists on the George Bush campaign. That is the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, dating back to the Crusade for Freedom and Alan Dulles' Fascist Freedom Fighters program that I alluded to earlier. And the networking that we've been talking about evolved right on up through the 1988 campaign and even beyond that. We should note, of course, that ultimately, perhaps the single most notable event of the George Bush administration was the Persian Gulf War. George Bush received great publicity and was viewed as a national hero for having led us in the Persian Gulf War. Well, there are a lot of very interesting aspects if one begins to investigate the Gulf War. In the first place, it turned out that Saddam Hussein had been in bed with the Reagan and Bush administration all along, that a lot of the weaponry that he ultimately wound up using against U.S. troops had been supplied by the Western nations under the Iraqgate BNL scandal, and that in turn had been channeled by George Herbert Walker Bush. It also turned out that an outfit called Tanox Biosystems Incorporated, that's a Texas-based biotechnology company, had apparently been involved in trafficking some genetically engineered microorganisms called a mycoplasma to Saddam Hussein. This is a small infectious and pathogenic microorganism which appears to have been genetically altered by inserting a gene, the protein sheath gene, from the AIDS virus into it, and this makes it much more infectious. It makes it much more pathogenic. It can invade cells. This was developed by Tanox Biosystems Incorporated, that's a Texas-based biotechnology company. Two of the principal stockholders are George Herbert Walker Bush and James Baker, his Secretary of State. George Bush's national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft, was a principal stockholder in the company that manufactured the slant drilling equipment that Kuwait was using to drill across the border into the Iraqi part of an oil pool that lay on the Iraqi-Kuwait border. And that was one of the reasons why Saddam Hussein wound up invading Kuwait. In fact, there are indications that some signals were sent by Western oil companies that they would not be too upset if, in fact, Iraq invaded Kuwait. Well, it turns out that they were. But it's worth noting that the weapon we were told about, Saddam Hussein, the evil dictator, people can perhaps remember the rhetoric surrounding the Persian Gulf War. Well, it turned out that signals were sent by Western oil companies to Saddam Hussein that in all likelihood he could get away with invading Kuwait. Turned out that the specialized drilling equipment that the Kuwaitis were using to drill into the Iraqi half of this oil pool that they shared was, the principal stockholder was Brent Scowcroft, and it turned out that much of Saddam Hussein's weaponry had been illegally channeled to Saddam Hussein under the auspices of the Iraqgate machinations, and George Bush was in charge of that. And the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism and the networking that evolved out of that, were basically what George Bush utilized for the Iraqgate machinations. Now, at this point, George Bush's Secretary of Defense is Dick Cheney, the former White House Chief of Staff under Gerald Ford. Remember, we've been following this through a number of decades, and I'm going to have to get busy here if we're going to... Well, we got way up to 11, but... We're almost up to the 1990s, so I'll try and telescope some of this a little bit here in the interest of time. But again, bear in mind that Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense at this time, and because of the success of the Persian Gulf War, Dick Cheney got basically a lot of very fruitful introductions into Middle Eastern oil circles, which ultimately he parlayed into his CEO position as head of Halliburton Oil. But it's worth remembering that the single most important event of the Bush administration, arguably the Persian Gulf War, was something that was to a large extent manufactured by the Reagan and Bush administrations. And had that been properly investigated, George Bush would have been convicted of treason. Ultimately, George Bush was defeated for re-election, largely because of economic matters. Just before leaving office in 1992, about a week before Cap Weinberger was going to stand trial for his offenses in the Iran-Contra affair, George Bush pardoned many of the key players in the Iran-Contra affair. He pardoned several key Bush administration, Reagan administration figures, and also a couple of key CIA figures as well. This was right before leaving office. This should have been reason enough, if nothing else, for people to have recoiled in horror at the name of George Bush on another national ticket, but it didn't. Bear in mind that Congress had cut off aid to the Contras, and the Reagan and Bush administration had simply thumbed their nose at the Constitution and at Congress and said, up yours, we don't care, we're not going to pay any attention to this, to hell with the Constitution and the law, we're going to do what we want. But nonetheless, George Bush did get away with it, and ultimately left office without having been convicted. The guy should have been put in prison for the rest of his life. It's interesting, too, that bear in mind that his campaign manager had been Roger Ailes, and that Roger Ailes then went on to be Rush Limbaugh's producer when Bill Clinton took office. Bill Clinton finally, I'm going to move quickly through the Clinton administration on up to the present. Bill Clinton, I don't think has ever really been president. At the end of 8 years, or almost the end of 8 years, I have more questions than answers about Bill Clinton. He spent six of those 8 years with the Gingrich Congress behind him. What exactly he is about as a political animal, I can't say. When you think about the scandals that we've been presented, we've Travelgate, nothing. Filegate, nothing. Special prosecutor appointed for each of those, nothing. The Whitewater investigation, 6 years and $52 million later, came up with nothing. No indictments. And because of the fact that Jennifer Flowers was allowed to sue Bill Clinton while he was sitting, while he was the seated president, the Monica Lewinsky affair came to be investigated by the special prosecutor. Basically, that was a BJ. That's all they came up with for 6 years and $52 million. But yet, look at the way the press has hounded Bill Clinton. You hear all about the Clinton scandals. Well, you know, what Clinton scandals? I mean, other than a BJ, which is just not that much of a scandal, particularly not in light of some of the dropping of pants that allegedly has taken place around the Bush family in recent years. But at the end of 8 years, look at how many people can really say what Bill Clinton is about? He's had bullets whizzing around his ears. He's never really been president. He's certainly an individual who is relatively conservative from an economic standpoint. I never thought that there was a hell of a lot involved with Whitewater. Hillary Clinton was paid $20 a month by the Rose Law Firm for her work on Whitewater. Lawyers don't commit crimes for $20 a month. Hell, street kids aren't going to commit crimes for $20 a month. That's just not enough money to commit a crime. It is worth noting, though, that in the background of some of the Clinton scandals, we see some of this same networking. Linda Tripp, who's the gal who finally convinced Monica Lewinsky to go public with all of this, Linda Tripp was a Bush White House appointee. She was the last person to see Vince Foster alive when she served him lunch. Foster then turned up dead. There was a blonde female hair found in the body. Nobody ever asked whether that might have been Linda Tripp's. Linda Tripp held a very high security clearance when she worked at the Pentagon. She had been involved in counter-terrorist activities, doing sensitive clerical work for the Delta Force. And she, in turn, had been requisitioned in order to conduct this crusade against Clinton by a woman named Lucy Goldberg, who was Mark Furman's literary agent. Lucy Goldberg had worked for the Dirty Tricks Department of the Nixon White House under Murray Chotiner. Murray Chotiner being the mob lawyer who worked for Mickey Cohen, the syndicate boss of Los Angeles, and who dredged up Richard Nixon's political career, literally financing his first congressional campaign out of the coffers of Mickey Cohen. And Lucy Goldberg had been a political dirty trickster infiltrating the McGovern campaign, explicitly working for Murray Chotiner under the Nixon White House. So again, we're looking at some of this long-term, decades-long networking. It's going to be very, very interesting. Again, I think in terms of assessing George W. as a political animal, it is not only fair but necessary to assess the political legacy to which he's heir. Aside from that, George W.'s political advisors read like a who's who of his father's political advisors, and the oil industry is deeply, one cannot take a look at a possible George W. administration and not take a look at the power politics of petroleum. Dick Cheney, of course, is his vice presidential candidate. He had been Secretary of Defense during the Persian Gulf War, and because of the entrees that he gained in Middle Eastern circles, was able to parlay that into his position as CEO of Halliburton Oil. 2 years ago, under Cheney, Halliburton bought Dresser Industries, the largest oil field drilling company, and the company with which George Herbert Walker Bush got his very first job in the oil industry and probably in the intelligence community when he graduated from Yale. Remember, this was all the way back in the immediate post-World War II period when Prescott Bush Sr. tabbed his fellow bonesman, Henry Neal Mallon, and fellow friend of Alan Dulles, in order to get George his position with Dresser Industries. Dresser Industries ultimately was absorbed into Halliburton Oil. Cheney is now the vice president, the vice presidential candidate under George W. Bush. If George W. Bush gets elected president, in all likelihood, his Secretary of State is going to be Condoleezza Rice, who was a State Department official under George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. She is a director with Chevron, by the way, and it was just, they just named an oil tanker for her. Another of George Bush's key advisors is Michael Boskin. Michael Boskin is a key advisor to George W., and Michael Boskin is a director with Mobil Exxon. So you begin to get the idea that the fact that here we have another George Bush, another oil man, running for president of the United States, or in 1980 we had him running for vice president, although he was the real power behind the throne, and all of a sudden, look what's happening. The price of oil is soaring. It threatens the economic stability of not only the United States, but the rest of the world. And now, surprise, surprise, the Middle East is heating up. The day that Bush named Cheney as his vice presidential candidate is the day that Arafat broke off talks with Barack and with Bill Clinton at Camp David. That was the end of those talks. My guess is that Arafat understood that he would get a better break from a pro-oil and consequently pro-Arab Republican administration than he would ever get from Bill Clinton. But we have the Middle East heating up again. The price of oil is going up. It's threatening the stock market. Inflation looms, although it remains to be seen what action, if any, the Fed takes. But there's been a lot of speculation in the media about the possible effect of this on the presidential campaign, because traditionally, when the stock market takes a big dip in October, the October preceding a presidential election, that traditionally portends a change of administrations. And I would note, too, that we've just had, just this past week, we've had an attack on a U.S. warship in, surprise, surprise, the Persian Gulf, and another terrorist incident proving once again that the United States is a helpless giant, or at least this is the rhetoric coming out of the Bush campaign. We're being told, on the one hand, that Clinton was a bad boy for having released the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He said, look, he released the oil reserves, and now we're involved in a war in the Persian Gulf. Dick Cheney is making noises about how this portends a huge intelligence failure on the part of the United States, the fact that the coal was attacked. And it remains to be seen whether the rising price of oil does in fact lead to across-the-board inflation. Historically, every time there has been an oil shock, Every time the price of oil has soared, it has resulted in a recession in the Western industrial nations. It was true in the 70s, and it may very well prove to be true in the 1990s. And the main suspect being voiced in connection with the attack on the coal that took place this past week is Osama bin Laden, who in the 1980s was working with U.S. intelligence and working specifically for some of the covert operations being directed by William Casey in Afghanistan. Remember William Casey from the International Rescue Committee, the Crusade for Freedom, the Reagan campaign in 1980, then director of CIA. And Osama bin Laden, bear in mind, his family in all likelihood channeled some of the money that went to start up Arbusto Energy. So a very, very interesting case of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra used to put it. Here we are more than 20 years later, and a remarkably similar set of circumstances is engulfing the Middle East. Not only the Middle East, but quite possibly the United States and the industrialized world. But also note that in the run-up to the year 2000 campaign, a person who bore a very famous name was killed in a plane crash, and it was only after he died that I learned that his name was actually being considered as a possible running mate for Al Gore. He was being actively considered for a spot on the ticket in the year 2000. That person was John F. Kennedy Jr. John F. Kennedy Jr. had promised his mother he would not engage in political activities because basically his mother was scared as hell that he'd get killed like his father and his uncle. His mother passed away in 1994 or 5, I'm not sure which, I think it was 94. John F. Kennedy Jr. was reported to be seriously considering a run for political office to help shore up the political legacy of his father and his uncle. I didn't know much about John Kennedy Jr. Most of what I knew about the guy was from waiting on the checkout line at the supermarket. But I saw on the first anniversary of his death, I saw the videotapes of several appearances that he had made on talk shows, you know, Jay Leno and so forth. He was a very, very articulate guy, and apparently was very involved, very concerned politically. He had stayed out of electoral politics in order to honor his mother's wishes, but he was very concerned about the debasement of his father's political legacy and was actively considering whether or not he was going to get into politics. After his death, the talking heads on television discussed the fact that had he lived, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party was going to try to get him on the ticket in the year 2000. He was when I saw him, I was very surprised at how, well, I mean, I knew he was a handsome guy from the pictures, but he really came across very well in person. If people are wowed about Joe Lieberman and Dick Cheney and their interpersonal skills, just imagine if John F. Kennedy Jr. were running on the Democratic ticket with Al Gore. That would pretty much ice this election. Well, of course, it is not going to ice the election because he was killed in the crash of a private plane. I am very suspicious about the crash of that plane because the evidence suggests that the facts are different from what we were told. We were told that they didn't know. Remember when the plane crashed in the summer of 99? For several days, they were looking for the plane. They didn't know where it had gone down. They didn't know where it was. Witnesses had seen the plane. It had been cleared for landing at Martha's Vineyard Airport. It was within visual contact of the airport. An eyewitness said he saw the plane explode. And then after days of supposedly trying to find out where the plane was, they produced a radar track which showed the plane going straight down. Well, if they were tracking the plane by radar to where they could show just where it crashed, how come for days they were saying that they didn't know where it was? I think the evidence suggests the possibility, at least, of foul play, and one wonders whether perhaps Skull and Bonesman George W. Bush was, as they say in organized crime circles, making his bones with regard to yet another John Kennedy, seeing to it that he would not interfere with the political legacy to which he is heir and the political legacy which his progenitors have put into effect very, very, very forcefully over the years and have backed up with deadly force whenever they wished. I'd also think it should be noted that when he became governor, George W. Bush is flying around in a plane, 08 Foxtrot, a Beechcraft King Air 200 that was originally recruited as part of the Contra support effort by, part of the fleet to support the Contras by Barry Seal, one of the top drug smugglers in the United States, a fellow who was deeply involved in the Contra support effort and whose drug and espionage activities were conducted on behalf of George Herbert Walker Bush. Ultimately, this Beechcraft King Air 200 went through a series of very, very bizarre machinations. It is now in the fleet of the governor of Texas, and is reported to be George Bush's favorite aircraft when he's flying around. And this was a plane that was being used by Barry Seal for drugs. It has been alleged that the same plane was involved in a sting at Tamiami Airport that Barry Seal set up. He had been, Tamiami's a very important private airport outside of Miami, and Barry Seal was reported to be setting up a sting in which two wealthy Texans were going to fly into town and pick up a kilo of cocaine each for an elite party, and those two Texans allegedly turned out to be Jeb Bush and George W. That has never been confirmed. This was allegedly videotaped, but while pursuing that trail, and that videotape has never emerged, nor has that sting ever been confirmed, Mike Rupert came across the 08 Foxtrot plane, and 08 Foxtrot, again a drug smuggling aircraft that was used by Barry Seal, is George W. Bush's favorite plane. After his formal retirement for president, George Bush has been earning millions of dollars doing speeches on behalf of the Unification Church of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, specifically doing speeches on behalf of a Latin American newspaper that I think is called El Tiempo Mundo, the World Times. And because of the aid that the Unification Church had given to the so-called dirty, the fascists involved in the dirty war in Argentina, when Moon attempted to open an Argentinian newspaper, this was very, very controversial in Argentina. George Bush has done a number of speeches on behalf of the Moon Organization in Argentina, and that has helped to open doors. The Moon Organization, although ostensibly Korean, really appears to be an extension of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies, the combination religious cults and organized crime syndicates and intelligence organizations that were utilized to bring fascism to Japan in the 1920s and 1930s. Korea had been a Japanese colony up until 1945, and the early officers with the Unification Church had been officers in the Imperial Japanese Army in World War II. Two of the key early figures for the Moon Organization were both held as war criminals and imprisoned by the United States as war criminals in Sugamo Prison, a guy named Roichi Sasakawa and a guy named Yoshio Kadama, both of whom later on went on to be major political power brokers in post-war Japan. But that's the subject for a second lecture in and of itself. But one should note that the Unification Church has been deeply involved with the Asian People's Anti-Communist League and forces hailing to the Japanese fascist regime of the pre-World War II and World War II periods, as well as some of the other iron-fisted regimes of Southeast Asia during the Cold War period. Syngman Rhee in Korea, for example, was one of the people under whose auspices the Unification Church was launched. But the big money for the Unification Church appears to come from Japanese heavy industry. Although nominally Korean, it appears to be an extension of Japanese fascism, and it is for this organization that George Herbert Walker Bush has basically been pitching in his post-presidential career. We don't hear too much about that, though. We're hearing only about him going on speedboat trips at Kennebunkport and what a great guy he is and what a wonderful mom Barb is and, gee, isn't this really a terrific family and they're just folks. And George W. is not too bright, but he's really a pretty nice guy and he knows how to cuss and drink with the boys, you know, and he likes to read to kids and he's really just a real education-minded kind of regular guy, a compassionate conservative. I don't know what that means exactly, but who knows? Perhaps that's some of the activities that Father Ritter was engaged in at Covenant House. Maybe that's compassionate conservatism. I don't know. But it is really bizarre to watch this guy being handled by a very pliant press and a political establishment which would seem to be absolutely intent on doing anything but accurately portraying the truth about George W. Bush. And again, it's not very easy to talk about the guy as governor of Texas. The governor of Texas doesn't do very much. He's ranked 17th. On the power flow chart of Texas government. Texas legislature meets every other year, and generally their business is done by the end of May. And he's just basically been rubber stamping everything big business has wanted in Texas. It's one of the most polluted places on earth, has one of the worst public school systems in the entire industrialized world. The Texas state health care system has been in effect put in federal receivership. A judge has just rebuked the state for its neglectful handling of health care for impoverished children. But none of this seems to be impacting on people very much. We're just told about, you know, well, he's a nice guy and he doesn't smirk as much and he's a really pretty good guy and he's doing this and doing that. And yet, when one looks at what George W. is, We can realize, I think, that we are not being told anything even remotely resembling the truth about what this guy is. He is, in fact, the heir to a legacy. It is a very, very powerful legacy, a very deadly legacy, and an utterly inhuman legacy, and one which is, sadly, on the public record, although, granted, the public doesn't get a lot of access to that record. It's why I've taken the time to delineate what the Bush family has been involved with. And believe me, there's a lot more. If you like this, there's a lot more where this comes from, too. And we may be having 4 to 8 more years of this if, in fact, George W. gets elected. But he's been quite candid about the fact that he's going to turn to his father's advisors. And this is supposed to compensate for the fact that he has the intellect of a park bench. But I think that Even if one did not know much about the state of Texas, I think, as I said at the very beginning of the lecture and a couple of times since, I think it is not only fair but essential to evaluate George W. in terms of the political legacy to which he is heir and in terms of the network, the words that I've used before, networking. Now, if the confluence of forces and individuals that I've just described doesn't constitute networking, I don't know what does. The concept of power elite, because the Bushes are part of the power elite, and the others with whom they've worked, the Fords, the Cheneys, the Nixons, the Dulleses, are also members of that power elite. And although George W. may be a good old boy from Texas who, you know, wears cowboy boots and can spit and cuss and drink with the boys, he really is part of the Eastern establishment and the Eastern power elite. So in terms of understanding the political legacy to which he is heir, what does the W in George W. Bush stand for? The W in George W. Bush stands for fascism.